At the beginning of March, Iranians went to the polls. Or rather, some Iranians went to the polls. On March 4th, Iranian Interior Minister Ahmed Vahidi addressed reporters about the vote. Around 25 million people participated, with a turnout of 41%. In fact, when the final tally was taken, the overall turnout was just 40.64%. In the capital, the turnout was even lower, recording just 24%. This was less than an ideal result for the ruling Iranian regime, although Interior Minister Vahidi did try to put a good spin on it. The vote took place despite the ill wishes of the nation, including intelligence services and terrorist groups trying very hard to undermine security. This week, we look at the Iranian elections. Why was the voter turnout so low? How did the regime control the elections? And what can the recent election tell us about the all-important question of who will succeed Iranian Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei? I'm Hugo Goodridge, and you're listening to The New Arab Voice. Polling stations for Iran's 2024 legislative elections were opened on March 1st. Although in the run-up to the vote, the general mood among the electorate was less than inspired. As one resident of Tehran put it,
"The previous ones made promises, but nothing changed. Just take a look at the bazaar and the poor kids living on the streets. We need an official who takes action, not just campaigns."
Iranians were voting in two elections. The first for the 290-seat Islamic Consultative Assembly, the country's parliament. This is the body that legislates laws. And the second vote was for the Assembly of Experts, an 88-seat body comprised solely of Islamic legal scholars. The Assembly of Experts, in line with the Iranian constitution, are responsible for supervising, dismissing, and electing the supreme leader. But more on that later. Going into the election, Iran was facing a litany of issues and challenges. The economy was a major issue. When former President Trump walked away from the Iran nuclear deal, economic sanctions were once again placed on the Iranian economy. In 2021, when current Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi came to power, inflation stood at around 45%. In 2023, the central bank announced that inflation stood at 46.5%. Iranian consumers have seen the price of some foodstuffs rise by more than 90%. The general feeling among economists watching Iran is that 2024 could see a fall in inflation, but not enough of a fall, and certainly not enough to alleviate the economic pain felt by consumers. As such, the economy and the government's handling of the economy was a key issue for voters. Another key issue was social in nature. The elections at the start of March were the first elections the country had seen since the murder of Mahsa Jina Amini at the hands of Iran's morality police, and the widespread protests that followed. These votes were an opportunity for the Iranian people to go out and make their voices heard at the ballot box. And yet, they didn't. Iranians, for the most part, stayed at home. Why? Here's Alex Vatanka, the director of the Iran program at the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C.
The main fundamental reason, which is extremely hard for anyone who looks at this objectively to ignore, is the fact that there's no point in having elections when there is really no competition of ideas.
The low turnout at the recent election was not unique to this round of voting, as explained by Ali Vaez, the Iran project director at International Crisis Group.
So this was the lowest turnout elections in the history of the Islamic Republic, but it was in fact part of a pattern. It was the third elections in a row which have witnessed historically low turnout rates. And this is indicative of the fact that the Islamic Republic has basically turned the page on looking at the institution of elections as one of the pillars of its legitimacy.
The lack of a competition of ideas which contributed to the low turnout was not a coincidence or abnormality. It was by design. Alex again.
So in the case of the Islamic Republic, elections have never been free or fair. It's always been the case that the regime, unelected institutions, primarily the office of the supreme leader, they essentially handpick who can run for office. But in the past, they were perhaps a little bit more lenient in terms of who they let run for office. In recent years, in the last few elections, they have been very selective, to the point that it's essentially hard to ignore the fact that these elections are just a show, that there's no competition.
Eligible Iranians can put themselves forward to be candidates in the election. The list of potential candidates is then assessed by the Guardian Council, who make the final decision on who can and cannot run for office. There are 12 members on the Guardian Council. 6 experts in constitutional law, nominated by the Chief Justice and approved by Parliament, and 6 experts in Islamic law, appointed directly by the Supreme Leader. The reality of the situation is more tainted than it looks at first sight, given that the Chief Justice is appointed by the Supreme Leader. Essentially, this gives the Supreme Leader complete authority of who is on the Guardian Council. The Guardian Council wields huge power in Iran, as laid out by the Constitution. It can veto any legislation put forward by the Parliament. It is responsible for supervising elections and also holds the power to approve or disqualify individual candidates for not only parliamentary elections, but also local elections, presidential elections, and the assembly of experts. The Supreme Leader ultimately has control over who sits on the Guardian Council. The Guardian Council decides who can and cannot stand for elections. Ali Vaez.
You know, the elections in Iran were never free, were never fair, but they were competitive. And by abandoning even that limited competition that was allowed within the system through a very stringent vetting processes that would eliminate even loyal critics within the system, I think we've reached a stage that elections are just theatrical in nature and basically have no consequences for the political trajectory of the Islamic Republic.
So the low turnout should perhaps not come as too much of a surprise.
And over time, it appears that increasingly the system has moved away from the Republican elements in its system more towards a purely theocratic and autocratic system. It also is part of a pattern in which the majority of the Iranian people seem to have given up on the regime, who in turn has given up on the majority of the Iranian people. And today, the leadership only cares about its narrow constituency, which was estimated to be around 10 to 25% of the Iranian society, who for vested economic or ideological interest in the regime would want to preserve the status quo.
In the eyes of the Iranian electorate, there was a lack of credible candidates. They did not believe that those on offer had the ability nor political intention of addressing the needs of the country and implementing the reforms sought by Iranians. The Iranian elections were purely theatrical in nature, hence the turnout of just 40.64%. The record low turnout was an interesting development, but not wholly unexpected. In the run-up to the vote, calls for boycotts had somewhat drowned out the calls by the regime for all Iranians to take part. Writing from a cell in the notorious Evin prison, Iranian human rights activist and Nobel Peace Prize laureate Nagaz Mohammadi urged Iranians to reject the vote.
The Islamic Republic deserves national sanctions and global condemnation. Sanctioning elections is not only a political necessity, but also a moral duty.
Adding,
the Islamic Republic, with its ruthless and brutal suppression, the killing of young people on the streets, the executions, and the imprisonment and torture of men and women, deserves national sanctions and global condemnation.
To actively call for a boycott of an election may appear to some to be a drastic move, perhaps even defeatist. But it also reflects the deep frustration with a system that will not move or change, even when a reformist-inclined candidate is elected. Alex Vatanka.
Time has shown, certainly to reformists, that that's not the case. Even in office, they haven't been able to change the trajectory of Iranian domestic policy or foreign policy. I mean, Hassan Rouhani, the last Iranian president, is not exactly someone we would associate with the reform movement, but he did get a lot of the reform support in the 2013 and 2017 elections. And if you look at him, what did he actually achieve? What policies was he able to decide to go away from the wishes of the Supreme Leader or the Revolutionary Guards? And the answer to that is none. And that's a reality that, you know, folks in Iran, voters, including the reformists who are still on the margins and still exist, but they basically decided this is not worth our effort. B, which is equally important, if not more important, it was pretty certain that reformists, prominent members of the reform movement, were not going to be allowed to run. Even if they wanted to contest these elections, they were not being allowed to run.
The power in Iran that prevents reform is often referred to as the deep state.
The deep state in Iran, which is represented by the Supreme Leader's office and the Revolutionary Guards, have tried to stymie any kind of viable, meaningful reform. And that has, over time, resulted in loss of hope in being able to achieve change through ballot box within large swaths of the electorate. Still, some people go out to vote because they fear it might have consequences for their own safety and security and job prospects.
The machinations that keep reformists off the ballot paper and that prevent the reforms of those who do manage to slip into office aid and service this deep state, and at best do nothing for the Iranian people, and in their worst and most common forms, hurt the Iranian people.
And this really demonstrates that the inner circle, both at the top of the political elite and at the level of their supporters, is continuing to shrink. With it, the competence of the system to be able to address the serious challenges, mega crises that it's dealing with, from years of economic stagflation to serious challenges in the region and in the nuclear standoff with the West, through societal discontent, which has resulted in frequent episodes of unrest, which the regime has resorted to brute force to crack down on. These are issues that could only be resolved with a degree of pluralism and with allowing more competent policymakers to come to positions of power.
And Alex Vatanka.
At this point in the lifespan of the Islamic Republic, most Iranians have come to conclude either this regime will collapse under its own weight or change will come from the streets. It will have to be mass protest. It would have to be something similar to a revolution of perhaps even similar to what happened in 1979. That this system as it is, with the institutions being put together the way they are and the balance of power, that it doesn't really matter who gets elected. Those are the hard realities that we need to take into account when we discuss the idea of political change coming through the ballot box.
Most of you listening will probably remember the intense protests that followed the murder of Mahsa Jina Amini in 2022. Beaten to death by the morality police, who accused her of not properly observing the country's strict hijab laws. These protests were the latest witnessed by Iran. But there have been others, some equally intense.
They used to be limited to the middle classes. Now every single segment of society comes out, including the poor, the working class, rural areas that never really were politically minded. Now they are coming out in the streets occasionally, as we've seen in the last half decade. So something is definitely changing on that front. The numbers are getting greater, and that's a reflection of the fact that people's grievances are not going away, or in fact getting deeper as the regime refuses to change its ways.
The protests seen in Iran in recent years have continued to grow in size, spread, and intensity. So why haven't they been able to succeed?
The system sees them as existential, sees them often as a Western conspiracy aimed at undermining the Islamic Republic and toppling it. And so it does not see a need to change behavior when it believes that the threat that it's facing is aimed at changing the regime. And this is why it often resorts to brute force to suppress the protests without really addressing the underlying causes that have led to those protests. And as a result of it, what it does is that it only buys time until the next round of unrest, which could be triggered by any event, because Iran is really like a tinderbox, given the degree of discontent that exists across the board, from economic malaise to social restrictions that are constantly being pushed back, especially by the younger generation in Iran, to political stagnation and the fact that people believe that they no longer have a say in their own future.
Violence is the obvious answer. Faced with a threat, the regime does not hesitate. They attack ferociously.
Khamenei has not allowed anyone to become a prominent name. Even folks within the regime are not allowed to stay too long because they might create their own power base. So in many ways, the challenge here is for the opposition, both inside of Iran and in the diaspora, which is a very significant part of this story, to sort of start maybe doing things differently going forward. Because frankly, as of today, the vast energy that you find in the Iranian diaspora that's against the Islamic Republic, wants change and all the rest of it, it's been wasted, and it's certainly not been taken seriously by the Islamic Republic. And if you could turn that around, if you could make the regime in Tehran actually fear the opposition, both in Iran and abroad, then that might just shape their calculations going forward.
At home, most of political figures so stand a chance of leading a revolutionary movement are currently in prison. The Islamic Republic has cracked down on civil society for years now, and really there is no viable organized alternative inside the country that can stand up and face the regime. And outside of the country, the exiled opposition is busy fighting one another, and they are at times more intolerant than the regime itself. And therefore, again, they do not offer a viable alternative and a positive vision for the future of the country. And so not all the circumstances that are necessary in order to transition to something better are currently in place. And that is why, you know, the future seems quite bleak. And if there are additional episodes of unrest, they're likely to meet with the same fate, because without leadership, without organization, and in the face of a brutal regime that would not hesitate to use force against its own people, the odds of success seem to be not promising, at least in the immediate future.
Any effective opposition or any attempt to form an effective opposition have been severely stamped out by the two ruling Iranian arms of the Supreme Leader and the Revolutionary Guard. It's a sad truth that the future of Iran is looking pretty bleak. Bleak, but also uncertain. As we mentioned, the election saw the vote of a new parliament and also the assembly of experts.
These are the 88 clerics who get to choose the next supreme leader. And, you know, we have never seen the members of the assembly of experts being so carefully vetted as was the case this time around. And that clearly is linked to the issue of succession and the fact that the 84-year-old Ali Khamenei and his advisors want to make sure they pack the assembly of experts with people they can trust to underwrite whatever decision they come up with in terms of who should succeed Ali Khamenei the day he dies.
Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei is 84 years old. In fact, he'll be turning 85 in just a few weeks, on April 19th. The issue of who will replace him when he does, inevitably, die, is perhaps the most pressing issue facing the country today.
Look, there are some speculation and some names that you hear, like Ayatollah Khamenei's second son, Mujtaba, or the current president, Raisi. But I don't think anyone knows for sure. This is a tightly kept secret. Those who know don't speak, and those who speak probably don't know. But the reality is, I think it's not too difficult to understand what the likely calculation is here.
Names do float around, but it's really speculation.
One has to assume he's spending a lot of energy on the succession process because that's the nature of his character. He's a micromanager. He's someone who, you know, given in an important meeting, will choose who sits where in that room. It's the level of detail the man gets into that oftentimes stands out about his personality. So the idea that he is not involved in thinking about the day after his death, to me, seems not serious. He is heavily involved, but he's also heavily secretive about it.
We don't know who it will be, but we can make an educated assumption about the type of person that it will be.
And the likely calculation is that, again, there is just so much vested interest in the status quo that there is an interest in trying to continue it and preserve it. And the best way of achieving that objective is not to bring about fundamental change. And a new supreme leader coming from a different perspective with a constituency of his own, he can actually bring about change. But if you engineer a process in which the next supreme leader is no longer supreme and is basically just the figurehead, then the current deep state would be able to preserve its interests. And if I wanted to guess, I would say we're very likely to see a setup in which you have a supreme leader who's either too old or too subservient to be able to have his own base or to become too powerful, but rather will be reliant entirely on the current office of the supreme leader, which is comprised of Ayatollah Khamenei's son and the Revolutionary Guards, so that they can basically continue as is, but just instead of Ayatollah Khamenei, who is the decision maker and who is the commander in chief and who is supreme, instead of him just having a figurehead. And in that sense, I think Iran is very likely to look like something like Pakistan or Egypt, in which the real power behind the veil is the military, even though you might have a civilian facade. But that is the likeliest trajectory for the Islamic Republic.
Those that wield the most power and influence in Iran are deeply embedded in the fabric of the country. Everything passes through them. Even when Khamenei does go, his strong influence will remain. And it's likely that we'll see him, in a sense, rule from beyond the grave, through the people he has elevated and share his ideas. But it's not the only option available to the country and the deep state.
It might perhaps be something entirely different. Maybe the idea of a single individual being the supreme leader will cease to exist, and we might have a difference, perhaps a council or something else. But we also have to remember, the Islamic Republic is about 45 years old today. The idea of supreme leadership didn't exist in Iran, or for that matter, in Islam, before 79. So it's a very new, relatively, phenomena. It's man-made. There's nothing in the Quran, in the holy text, that talks about a supreme leader. This is very much something that group of people back in late 70s came up with. And it could easily go away just as easily as it came on stage. Because today, the idea of a supreme leader, one individual, unelected, with unlimited powers, representing God on earth, it's such a dinosaur of a political concept that it's hard to see how even defenders of the Islamic Republic might think this is the way going forward.
There was no choice for the Iranian people when they went to vote. It's why so many didn't vote. For the regime, it was a safe election. They stacked the deck to get their desired result. The regime does not want or need surprises today. For those at the top, everything must be focused on the decisions of tomorrow. Ali Vaez.
It's a loss of legitimacy in both directions, that the regime no longer trusts the people and the people no longer trust the regime, at least the majority of people. And that is a situation that, again, with the sheer will to suppress and to use violent means, a regime can preserve its power, but not in the long run. And, you know, Iran is not China. Iran is not other countries that have experienced long episodes of despotic rule. This is a country that had experienced two revolutions, two coups in the 20th century. You know, Iranian people are very restive, and you have, especially in border provinces where minorities live, whether they're ethnic or sectarian minorities, there is a high degree of discontent and displeasure with the system and with the status quo. And therefore, you know, it's not hard to predict that there will be more unrest, and they would each time become more ferocious and more violent. And the system at some point will be faced with a fundamental choice of either descending itself and the country into civil strife in the way that we've seen play out in other countries in the region, like in Syria or in Yemen, or you would see a regime collapse from implosion, basically, in the same way that the Shah's regime collapsed in 1979.
And final words to Alex Vatanka.
It is an authoritarian system, but it's not just about Ali Khamenei. Whether it was by circumstance or design, which one can debate, the fact is Khamenei has had to share power with the Revolutionary Guards, the men in uniform that have protected him against the masses. So Revolutionary Guards will not die when Khamenei dies. They will be there. And that, to me, is the biggest sign of some degree of continuity. The question is, what will they choose to do in terms of their agenda? Because once Khamenei is dead, the Revolutionary Guards would have a moment to actually choose to go in a different direction.
This episode of The New Arab Voice was written and produced by me, Hugo Goodridge. Our theme music was by Omar El Phil. The New Arab Voice will be back next week. Until then, you can find all our previous episodes on all major podcast platforms. Our roundup of all the biggest stories of the New Arab Weekly will be out with a new episode on Friday. Don't forget to subscribe to get notified for when a new episode drops. You can find a link in the show notes. You can also check out our Instagram page and Twitter accounts, both at TNA Podcasts, for additional content. And you can also email us, podcast@newarab.com. We also have a weekly newsletter which you can sign up for. Find the link in the show notes. You can subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. And you can also rate and review, which helps us spread the word. Don't forget to follow The New Arab on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram for all the latest news, analysis and opinion from the region.